and the U-shape becomes the center tab, which you scrape clean and eventually make contact to it. And of the two wires that you've just wound up, one going to the bottom of the pipe, one going toward the top of the pipe, one of them you clean up and it becomes connected to D3. The other one, you don't bother cleaning it. It doesn't go anywhere. Does that sound right, John? Go ahead.
Exactly, Dick. That's my vision of what he had created. Simple rolling pin action. It winds up, and you're right, they counterwound, and one is not connected. So one end is not connected. So I think you got the description exact.
The neat diagram, which you're calling circuit number two, and the crayon diagram, which you're calling circuit number one, does one give more light bulb illumination than the other? Over to you, Wes.
It's a good question. The neat diagram was the one we tried with 150 watts halogen before we start with 60 watts incandescent. Then we switched to 600 watts halogen. That was the end of that experiment. I wasn't there. I wasn't in Lithuania at that time. But Ida told me that he was able to reach 1 kilowatt. I didn't see that. So when I went to Lithuania, we have had 150, well, there was 100 watts, I'm sorry, 100 watt light bulb that was leading, in my opinion, at full brightness. The power delivered 3 watts and 2 xGA.
And I think we, part of the discussion last week is that the 3 watts delivered might need some more confirmation, that the 3 watts was derived in a non-direct manner. In other words, measuring the current drain of a signal generator when it was terminated with leads 1 and 3 after it was terminated by a green transformer, as opposed to, I think, going into an open circuit. So the difference in current drain was 3 watts. That's not quite evidence yet that lead 1 and 3 got 3 watts.
There was one significant thing, that 600 watts that was done at first experiment, where I was not yet in Lithuania, was done with the same generator that we was using, the same green transformer. And to actually,
The neat diagram shows a 220 volt 60 watt light bulb. I think you're saying there was once a 150 watt halogen, there was once a 60 watt, and there was once a 600 watt. Other than changing the wattage of the light bulb, the size and type of light bulb, were there other changes that took place in those three separate kinds of load? OUS, King 2 RIW.
Excellent question.
Yes, there was. The only difference was ferrite rod. Everything started when we met together. A gentleman from England, from Lithuania, and me. And we started to talk. Gentleman from Lithuania said, I'm playing with something, but I have no results. And my light bulb is dead. I have nothing on it. And I remember I was at TK place, and I've seen the device that works with 200 watts with one single impulse, not a battery, just one impulse for a period of 1 second for 30 minutes. I've seen it in my own life. I hold in my hands the device. There were no hidden wires, no batteries, no nothing. But I was analyzing that circuitry. Let me jump. I was analyzing the circuitry, and also TK experiment in Turkey when he was presenting 100 kilowatts of power that was triggered from 9 volt battery, one impulse only, and it was handling two motors. John would be able to recall that because he has seen this material. And the discussion with one of the friends of TK was that before, at the beginning of, the huge big spark, I don't know if you have seen that, the huge big spark of three phase, three coils, and another three coils on the perimeter, that was made for the purpose of the scientists at Turkey, and Westall, who was paying for this tremendous amount of money, to make sure that the voltage is there. The thing is that they put a copper plate on the walls and the ceiling and the floor. No, not the floor, just the walls and the ceiling of that huge room in Turkey to create the Faraday cage. They put the device on the glass table and the glass columns, so you could see clearly that there's nothing hidden. And the spot that was between the center coils and the sort of pickup coils, very much similar to the Tesla coil, was approximately 1.5 meter. 1.5 meter, 1 meter has 3 feet. Okay, so 5 feet. And then when I spoke to this gentleman, he said, listen, this was made up. That spark that you see in here was just because the scientists pushed TK to cut the wire to show that the voltage is there. But actually, in the real application, that spark doesn't exist. There are two hidden spark gaps that you cannot see. And I've memorized these two words. I have a huge respect to TK. Huge respect. I mean, he's a really good man. But for whatever reasons, he didn't reveal his secret as of yet. I'm dedicated to humanity. Whoever wants to laugh from it, laugh it now and do it here. I'm not making no secrets. 79 people died because of playing with the free energy, very mysteriously. I don't want to be one of them. Everything that I know is delivered to the public. So, at least I'm going to be smarter. Now, I said to Ida at that time, listen, put another spark up at the pickup coil. Aruna said, put the diode and put the capacitor. All of a sudden, we've got 60 watts working. But it wasn't like that. Ida said that he has a problem with his ferrite. His ferrite is getting hot only one moment, one teeny, teeny place. The ferrite was along the caduceus inside and was getting hot in only one place. So I said, listen, put two pieces of ferrite, put the paper divided to it to break the magnetic flux. And all of a sudden we can hear and we could see, because we were at video conference, that is working. Soon after that, we delivered with the leader of Verde 150 watts, and soon after that, we played with 600 watts on it. That was enough for me to spend the money. I'm not a rich man. If somebody thinks I am, I'm not. I'm a dedicated person. To go to Lithuania to see it in my own eyes. Yes, I've seen it. It works. It's not a hoax, it's not a joke. The same green transformer that I could cover with my finger was delivering the power at the place where I was at for 5 days, 20 hours a day, the approximately 100 watts, but it was delivered before, the same one. It's also evidence on it I can send to you, Dick. 600 watts. So it is working. Now the question is, are we talking about violation of the laws of conservation of energy? I believe not. We don't. We're just coupling to the energy sources. And to Adrian.
I know this is going to be a tough question, but if 3 watts in is giving either 600 or 100 or 150 watts of output, and we're coupling to the energy sources, do you have a guess as to where those energy sources exist? Where are they coming from? I know that's a tough one. Over to you, Wes.
With the design that we have made 2 weeks later, there was even ferrite from the old TV. I am pretty much for nuclear magnetic resonance. And that's why we discussed for the number of months before nuclear magnetic resonance and the is it possible, it's active, and eventually all the documents, including the Army experiment, standing that two frequencies only could make a destruction to the metal by itself, to the structure of the ferrite. That is documented. It's an Army experiment, and it's released to the public, so there is no secret. As far as the caduceus coil, I have asked you long time and many ago and many times, does the electrons flow from the device to the ground, or maybe from the ground to the device and to XGM?
And my belief is that lead number 11 from the flyback transformer, feeding diode D1 and D2 and capacitor C2, is charging capacitor C2 by way of capacitance to ground, capacitance to the universe, capacitance to the coil, capacitance to something that's not moving electronically, which could be that horizontal wire on the bottom left-hand part of the diagram that says caduceus marked as CDS. Okay, so that horizontal wire that's got a dot in the middle of it, now that has capacitance to anything by comparison to the voltage that's impressed on pin number 11. It will succeed by way of those diodes of charging C2. When C2 has a high enough voltage, the voltage on C2, the DC voltage on C2, is approximately equal to the DC voltage of spark gap number 2. And when spark gap number 2 does arc, a lot of the energy stored in C2 gets instantaneously applied to the CDS winding.
That's the spark gap number 1. Next to C2 on the nice diagram, we have a spark gap number 1.
You're right. I misunderstood. I don't have it blown up large enough, spark gap number 1. So when spark gap number 1 arcs, a good fraction of the stored energy in C2 appears across that primary winding that has the ferrite rod. And now some form of stepped-up voltage appears across D3, and there D3 gets charged, is charging C4, until the voltage on C4 gets large enough to arc spark gap number 2, and now C4 energy goes into the incandescent light bulb. That's what I believe is the theory of operation. And that waveform going into that light bulb could be very spiky because it's been through a double differentiating process. Spark gap number 1 is one kind of differentiation. Spark gap number 2 is a second. So I'm reasonably sure that the voltage waveform appearing on that incandescent light bulb in the neat diagram is a very nonlinear voltage. By normal means, to measure the energy being delivered to the light bulb, if you were making electronic measurements, I think it would be quite difficult. To measure the light output from the light bulb as at least the first cousin of energy delivered. But as you've heard me say before, I'm concerned that some of the light coming out could be ionization light as well as incandescent light.
You see an ionization light on the light bulb. I was precisely concentrating on being sure that we don't have ionization that is fooling us around. And especially in the first experiment, we see a tungsten just going up and going up with brightness. Back to you. And of course there was the halogen, so the distance between two ends was too big for the arc just jumping like we deal with the regular incandescent light bulb. Now, I would like to ask you to explain very specially from 11, from point 11 we have a two diodes. The same story is in Korean drawing, is the same. How come one wire, from one wire only we can power the caduceus because we don't have a second wire? So he could understand it, because I've heard your explanation before, but that would be good for the audience.
You could say that the upper end of a Tesla coil contains one wire, and that one wire, if the voltage is high enough, will arc to the air that's in the room, and is really arcing between that air and the rest of the stuff in the room that's grounded, whether it's the earth underneath the Tesla coil, or the metal or wooden walls of the room, and the ceiling, and the wiring of the room. So, an ordinary Tesla coil, when the voltage is high enough, you could say it gives you an arc with only one wire. A person who understands that is at the beginning of understanding of this phenomenon. By the way, for those who are listening, when you send an email to Bernie at bernie@huntfamily.com, he will be able to give you a copy of the diagrams that we've been talking about for the last 2 weeks.
Hunt at, it's bernie@huntfamily.com.
There you go, bernie@huntfamily.com. At that address, you can make a request for these diagrams that we're talking about, but I'm not sure that many people can easily explain the one wire coming out of a Tesla coil. How does that create an arc? When it comes to a spark plug in my automobile, there really are two terminals there. And I'm getting a much bigger spark out of a Tesla coil with only one terminal. There is another terminal, but it almost doesn't matter when the voltage is high enough. I wonder if you think that's the beginning of an explanation. Let me turn it over to John first. KC2WGV, K2RIW.
I agree with that analogy. It's absolutely true. But here, we're only dealing with 10,000 volt input to those two diodes. Now, if you think about it, the power that we are applying to that primary circuit, the caduceus coil, has to be returning back to the initial power supply. So now, through the air and the distance, look at that impedance. How much coupling could we have there? All right, let's assume we only have a milliwatt. Then this device is amplifying by thousands. That is a hard concept to follow. And I don't see how that could work. But, he said he saw this thing working. So, Dick, what do you think about the straight capacitance coupling? Or maybe it's inductive in some way. Coupling back that much energy. What's your thoughts on that?
I'm reasonably sure as time goes on, we're going to be attempting to confirm if the measurements do display excess energy output versus energy input. We're obviously eventually going to be asking ourselves, where is it coming from? When it comes to the waveform on pin 11 of the yoke transformer, television yoke, when that pin 11 at the instant is positive, it forward biases diode D1. It forces the voltage on the bottom horizontal wire with the dot in the middle of it. It forces that wire and its stray capacitance of the universe to go positive. On the second half of that cycle, when pin 11 goes negative, diode D2 conducts through capacitor C2 back into that wire. So on the first half cycle, you're driving the horizontal wire positive. On the second half of that cycle, you're attempting to drive that wire negative. If the voltage on 11 is high enough, and 10,000 volts could be high enough, plus or minus 10 thou, you're now with a two-step process putting charge onto C2. And once C2 voltage gets high enough and discharges spark gap number one, you're now putting a pretty large chunk of energy from C2 into the primary winding of that caduceus coil and starting the next step of the process. Right now, my gut feel is that the real power coming into the circuit and the power coming out of the circuit might be similar. I'll admit that doesn't sound right. West feels that 3 watts is going in and at least 60 watts or more is coming back.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But until we measure voltage and current on pin 1 and 3 throughout a complete cycle, I'm not convinced that we really know the power going into pin 1 and 3. And again, we've got a very nonlinear waveform, and therefore we've got to be careful in how we measure power / energy, because it's a function of voltage, it's a function of current, and it's a function of phase angle between the two at each instant of time. That's not easy, but since we're operating at tens of kilohertz with instrumentation that can go to megahertz, I think with proper use of that instrumentation, we can make this measurement. Not easy, but I know we can do it. Over to you for a comment on all that, Sean. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, what about, is this device somehow self-regulating? Because, listen, if you can put enough energy to light a 150-watt bulb, now you take it down to a 60-watt bulb or a 20-watt bulb, why doesn't the lower one blow?
You have a comment on this.
I suspect a lot of retuning took place every time a light bulb was changed. Over to you, Wes.
Interaction. That's what was strange, that we have seen a 60 watt light bulb in full brightness. Then we took 100 watts that was in Lithuania, full brightness. At the part that I have seen only through the video conference, we had a 150 watt halogen that was. Ida said that it was in full brightness. We have not seen the full brightness, but he has a very expensive microscope camera that has extremely good backlight compensation. So at that, we were able to clearly see the tungsten just going red. Then he exchanged it to 600 watts, and it was the same. Now, was it retuning? No, it was some sort of the retuning because he was maneuvering with the ferrite rod. At first experiment, we have used 2 ferrite rods because I said at the place where the ferrite is getting hot, put 2 ferrite rods and put the paper in between. Now, we've got an effect that we didn't see before, and the ferrite wasn't getting hot. Transformer, which was a regular Liebig transformer from regular TV, didn't burn up with 600 watts, 150 watts, and then even when I was in Lithuania, we deal with the same transformer exactly, and that was 100 watts and 60 watts. Now, the power supply that was utilizing a small green transformer from the Russian washing machine is as small that I can cover it with my finger. That's the output transformer. The transformer was powering all of the devices. And to action.
The question for me.
Yeah, I've got a question also. You first, John, go ahead.
Did anybody make an open circuit voltage test? In other words, at the lamp socket, without the lamp in it. Did anybody do that, Wes?
Yes, we did. That means you connected the light bulb only with one end, didn't light up.
No, remove the bulb and take a voltmeter and read what the voltage is on the socket without the lamp being in the circuit.
Well, at the Caduceus, at the pickup coil, we're talking 5,000 volts per wind, 90,000 volts per leg. That would be 180,000 volts per two legs. We never touch the second leg. We never use the second leg. We only operate with the center top and the end of the pickup coil that was close to the Caduceus output.
Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I see a couple of problems with removing the light bulb. You take the load off of a circuit like this with all of its nonlinear functions going on, and I'm pretty sure the operation is going to change a whole lot. Second of all, the voltages that we're talking about are so high, the next question is, what kind of instrumentation are you going to use? I guess a high voltage probe into an oscilloscope would be a beginning. But to remove the load, which changes the impedances of all kinds of places of the circuit, is going to change the operation. What's not clear to me is that when you go from a 60 watt to a 100 watt to a 150 watt to a 600 watt light bulb, what was changing?
Position of the ferrite.
Okay, so you reposition the ferrite every time you change a light bulb. The signal generator, was it requested to put out a sine wave, a square wave, a triangle wave? The signal generator feeding the green transformer, what was it requested, what kind of a waveform was it requested to generate, Wes? K2RIW, N2XJN to take it.
The waveform that you see on the diagram, the neat diagram, it is approximately the waveform that was requested, that was unchanged. We have two tunings on that sort of generator, tuning knobs, and I did not connect that yet. I just have it. I just don't want to burn it. So that the power supply I have, what I'm trying to do is, at the first experiment we were dealing with the two ferrite rods with the paper in Lithuania. We had also these two pieces of the ferrite, but one of them dropped to the floor and got damaged. So we dealt only with one. And eventually, we started to put that broken one inside the caduceus and found out that exactly the length of the broken part was the length between the two cross sections of the caduceus. And that would give us a desired effect. The theory that I have developed is that when you have on the caduceus the cross section, that's the accumulation of the peak of a deer. Because the caduceus does not really have a three winds. It does have a three winds, and then another three winds, there goes counterclockwise. Although, it is only one winding. Let me jump. So the theory that I have developed was that, let's say we have one end of the ferrite rod, could be tiny, at one cross section, which is P1, at the crayon drawing. And the other one is another cross section, which is P2, at the crayon drawing. When the input shows up at P1, for those who have a crayon drawing, please look at that, then the ferrite domain starts to switch from one end to the other. Before the ferrite domain will be able to switch fully, the peak shows on the another cross section. Now, the ferrite start to compare the position of the domain from the left-hand side and the position of the domain from the right-hand side. That acts as the temporary memory of the last impulse served from the P1. Before it switched to P2, P2 starts to switch the domain in the other direction. And also, the second impulse memorized over there is impacting the coil capacitor from the crayon drawing and the caduceus. Let me jump. And because the ferrite has permeability of 2000, it amplifies memorized effect, causing the structure to self-regulate itself. I believe this is the time when we could go to the crayon drawing to try to analyze it better. But before we do that, we've got to understand that one of the experiments that I have made with the flyback, which is a clear contradiction with the man that I admire for his knowledge, which is Glenn, talking about the thing, both of them, they're great people, let me tell you. Glenn said that when you have a flyback in a full saturation, it is going to burn up in a few seconds. I put the test the flyback, and I find out that no matter what I do, and I'm gonna I gave you also that material, the link to that, but I can repeat that if you need that. No matter what I put, a circle, a triangle, a square shape, or just a sign, at the particular frequency, which is 16.8 kilohertz, I'm getting clear, even amplitude of the sine wave of the from the flyback. This flyback that I was able to see in Lithuania was dead cold, was not even warm, under the laws of 100 watts. So there must be something in it. But then I said to myself, if Glenn is going to deliver to me that beauty, and he did, a transformer that does keep the shape, because of the special winding that he made to the transformer, at the frequency of 20 kilohertz, I'm delivering square shape. I'm getting a square shape. It does have a just slight slope. Just a, the rising time is okay. The trailing edge is just a little slope, but it gives me this beauty that I have never seen in my life. Now what I'm going to do is just deliver to point 11 and try to play with the shapes. I have made the purchase of a few generators just because I want to know how that will react if I try to have a frequency modulation or maybe the amplitude modulation on it. And this is going to be a set of the test. Back to you, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, if you're trying to assemble this in your mind, now, he just said that they changed the lamp wattage. We have to tune the ferrite core. All right. So now, are we saying if we put a low wattage bulb in there and tune that core, we could blow that bulb? What do you think? What's your concept on that?
Yeah, that I don't know. Wesley, I think you have said that one of the light bulbs was, in one of these experiments, burned out. Is that true?
Yeah, it was 100 watts light bulb. At the end of the day, we simply burned it up.
And the thing that was going on at the time you burned it up was just to move the ferrite rod, is what I think you're saying. By the way, the caduceus coil really is 3.5 turns. You start off on the left-hand side at one of those pieces of wire. You trace the way it winds in a spiral manner towards the right, and it stops moving toward the right and then moves toward the left. You're continuously turning in one direction. It really is not two different directions. It's one single winding of 3.5 turns, and you could say it's always a clockwise winding, if you know what I mean. So, as I see it, the current you put into the caduceus winding, although it's very spread out in an unusual manner, it's only making one single magnetic field down the solenoid of that caduceus coil. That's my belief.
So you see the canceling of the magnetic field because of the other part going in the reverse way, sort of.
What do you believe is going reverse? Are you talking about the CDS winding? The CDS winding, to me, is one single winding, 3.5 turns, all in one direction.
that when it goes to the end, from the left-hand side start, goes to the right-hand side, and then it turns back. Now it creates a cross-section with the first one. Do you see the cancelling of the magnetic field over there?
No, I don't. I see that very differently, Wes. The fact that the windings cross over each other in two places, as long as they're insulated, that doesn't bother me. And when you say it reverses in direction, I can start with one of those wires on the left-hand side, wind 1.5 turns clockwise, end up on the right-hand side, stop moving to the right, take down the wire, so to speak, keep winding in the exact same direction, but now sweep back to the left. It's one continuous winding. There is no reversed polarity, if you look at it correctly, in my opinion, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
No, I'm just asking a question. Another question is, do we have any accumulation in the cross-sections of the caduceus? And the second question is, do you see somehow that the theory that I have made has any basis in N2XJN?
It's my guess that if we did a careful analysis with a Hall effect device and look at the local magnetic field on the ferrite rod, and we investigated it 10 millimeters at a time along the length of the ferrite rod, it's my guess that any one instant of time, all the magnetic field in the ferrite rod is in one direction. If it's coming from the caduceus coil as the primary cause, and the caduceus coil, as I look at it, is 3.5 turns all in one direction, spread out horizontally in an unusual manner. But it's 3.5 turns all in one direction, and so if the primary source of energy that's magnetizing the ferrite rod is coming from the caduceus coil, it's my belief that the caduceus coil, throughout its length, will have one single direction of magnetic field at one instant of time. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Do you see that P1, whose trigger at one instant of time, switching domain to the right of the ferrite, then if we have a pulse accumulation on P2, it is switching domain to the left and side and to XGM.
P1, I think, is a crossover point between the beginning of the winding going to the right and the near end of the winding coming back to the left. And there's a similar phenomenon on P2. The fact that wires are crossing over at P1 and crossing over at P2, as long as they're properly insulated and not arcing through that crossover, I don't think creates any magic. That's my belief. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
How would you explain that with regular pickup coil, the ferrite was getting hot only in one single place, very narrow one, which then caused us to come to the conclusion to use two pieces of ferrite rod divided by the piece of paper, and then we've got the result. Would that be the indication of the local electromagnetic field being concentrated at one single point, which then leads to another conclusion? When we use only one ferrite cord, that was placed between two, that was that one that was broken one, between two cross-sections of the caduceus, the concentration of the energy was simply picked up by the ferrite, switching domain to the right, and then switching domain to the left. My understanding was that the first ferrite rod was too long, and it was getting cut. When we use a piece of ferrite, we didn't have that problem. And to exit.
Wes, you said that a portion of the ferrite rod got hot.
just one single plate. That was the first experiment that we have made. The ferrite was long, almost the length of the Katusha's coil. Was getting hard, and he said, listen, the ferrite is getting hard, only one single point. I said, put two ferrites in it. Put a paper divider in between them, along them. So we created even longer the ferrite with the paper divider. Then we've got the results. When I was in Lithuania then, that was 2 weeks later, just to see it on my own eyes, we didn't have one ferrite, and the one that we have had got broken. But it was exactly at the length between two cross section of the caduceus. This one didn't get hot. It was like the spread in one big long ferrite rod. It was a spread of the energy, changing the domain change to the right and to the left, creating some kind of perturbation in that point in which domain didn't know what to do, and then the friction create the heat and to exchange.
When the ferrite rod, the single ferrite rod, got hot, where? Left hand end, middle, right hand end?
In the middle, somewhere in the middle got hot. And that was the long one. So we replaced it on two. Now we have a two ferrite rods along each other, creating one long, but we have a paper divider. We didn't have a problem with heating ferrite. At the end of it, 2 weeks later, we just put a piece of ferrite at the proper length. We didn't have a problem with ferrite being hot, but we get the results.
When the ferrite got hot, how did you know that? Were you smelling it? Did you see it glow? How did you know the ferrite was getting hot?
Well, he took the ferrite out in his hand, and he found out it's hot. It was as hot that it was even hard to hold it in the hand, only in one particular place. So my understanding is that, yes, we are dealing with the concentration of energy, but when we use the proper length of the ferrite between two cross-sections of the caduceus, then the switching domain couldn't switch to the left because there was no ferrite over there. It could only switch to the right because that end of the ferrite was exactly the cross section of P2. Then when the concentration happened in one instance of the time in P1, then was switching domain to the other side. We didn't have a ferrite was cold. We didn't have this problem with you.
When the ferrite was being pushed in and out, the one long piece that did get hot, was it being pushed in and out with people's fingers or with an insulated tool?
With people's fingers. I told you. He was even touching the $90,000 with his hand and to exchange.
The piece of ferrite that got hot, roughly how long was it, and how many inches of it got hot on the single piece? Don't jump yet into the two pieces with the piece of paper.
Put half an inch area that was hot, and the ferrite was long, as long as the caduceus.
Roughly how long is that?
10 inches.
So a 10-inch long ferrite rod and a half of an inch got hot. When you had two pieces of ferrite separated by paper, were the two pieces of ferrite rod parallel to each other, side by side, or were they end to end?
End to end.
And they were separated by a piece of paper. How thick was that piece of paper?
Like a regular piece of paper, probably half a millimeter.
So in other words, the first ferrite rod was in the coil, a piece of paper was applied, and the second piece of ferrite rod was used as a pusher, pushing on the piece of paper, pushing the first rod. Is that what was done?
Exactly. But basically it was rubbed with the tape, so it doesn't go from the alignment.
So the two pieces of ferrite rod were arranged in a collinear manner with a piece of paper between them, and then wrapped with tape so that they stay as one long ferrite rod, roughly 10 inches long?
Tape file. Right.
Go ahead, Bernie.
We went almost 6 minutes without beep tones.
Did portions of the machine time out, Bernie?
I didn't check, but I suspect so. Just, we need to get some beeps in there, guys. Friendly reminder.
So when the two ferrite rods were collinear end-to-end held with tape with a piece of paper in between, was that combination 10 inches long?
The combination was twice long, and the ferrite didn't get hot.
If they were twice long, that means 20 inches long. Does that mean that it stuck out of both ends of the coil?
Make sure that that I have a proper length. I have those ferrites, they arrived from Ukraine. I'm going to take one and measure them, and I'm going to know exactly the length. Hold on.
I only need a rough approximation. How many inches long is the coil, and roughly how many inches long were the two rods? Did it stick out of both ends?
The coil is 10 inches. The original coil is 10 inches long, and the ferrite is, 7 inches and 3/4 long. And the diameter of the ferrite is, hold on, quarter of an inch. Hold on. Quarter of an inch.
I'm asking how long are the two rods end to end? Go ahead.
That would be two times 8 inches.
2 times 8 inches. Does that mean the two rods end to end were 16 inches long and they're being plugged into a coil that is 7 3/4 inches long? Go ahead.
It's correct. And the ferrite didn't get hot. But when we had just one ferrite, the ferrite was hot only in one single place. So when I went to the Lithuania, we had only one ferrite. We finally broke the one ferrite. It works with a piece of ferrite, and the ferrite piece of ferrite was exactly between two cross sections of the caduceus and didn't get hot.
If the two ferrite rods end to end and taped together are 16 inches long, and if the coil itself is a little bit less than 8 inches long, that means there's more than 8 inches left over. Was 4 inches sticking out of rod sticking out of the right side of the coil and 4 inches of rod sticking out of the left side of the coil? N2XJN, K2RIW, wait for the beep.
No, because the ferrite had to be positioned exactly at the point, and that was my request to IDAS. Put that junction exactly at the point where you previously had a hard ferrite, and when he tuned it this way, we've got the results.
Okay, that sounds like there was more rod sticking out of the right-hand side than the left-hand side because you put the junction between the two at the hot spot, and the hot spot was to the right of center. Is that true?
Right.
As you move that rod in and out, I think you're saying you did see the light bulb become more and less brilliant, N2XJN, K2RIW?
Correct.
Some point that's not clear, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
What was the length of the original rod that was getting hot, the one that broke? We didn't get that yet.
Inches.
When it broke, did it break into 2 pieces 4 inches long?
No, actually, to 3 pieces. We took one piece, probably the shortest one, and then we put into the caduceus that was in Lithuania. We placed that at the cross section of the caduceus, and it was working, and didn't get hot.
The original rod that got hot, the spot that got hot, was that approximately under that foil capacitor?
Correct.
Now, when I say foil capacitor, I mean the one that's got 2 number 1 leads and 2 number 2 leads. I'm not talking about the CL3. Is that true?
Correct.
Although CL3 is approximately centered in the foil capacitor. Is that true?
No. The coil capacitor was more to the right of the caduceus coil.
which is pretty much what the diagram is showing.
That is correct.
So the ferrite rod, I think you're saying, is roughly a quarter inch diameter, and when you had two of them taped together, the total object was close to 16 inches long.
That is correct.
And as you position the piece of paper right under the hot spot, what was used to be a hot spot, I think you're saying that's when you get the maximum brilliance out of the light bulb, and with that arrangement, I think you're saying you were able to go to a higher wattage bulb and get nearly full brilliance.
Affirmative.
The actual signal generator, is that made out of transistors, power transistors?
On the actual generator, we have a few small transistors and no power transistors. One optical isolator and one chip that looks like a typical TTL.
That signal generator, it has knobs that allow you to adjust the frequency, the amplitude, and the DC offset. Is that true?
Just two of them.
The signal generator, is that a commercial product, or is that a specially made product for this project?
Specially made product for any project, homemade, and wasn't properly investigated in terms of the properties. It was just made to work and deliver.
Let's double check. Is there anyone listening to us that wants to make a comment, question, or whatever? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW. Okay, I heard none. Was that signal generator ever put into a pure resistive load where measurements were made as to the waveform and current and whatever that comes out as you adjust the controls? Was it ever put into a resistive load to test the signal generator all by itself? OBUS, K2RIW.
No collected data at my point, at my side, I cannot guide us for it.
Are you about to build a signal generator just like that one, Wes?
No, I don't. I have an access to it. I don't want to damage it. It's just the evidence, and I don't want to play with it. We also use the same generator tool. Many other attempts, but the bottom line is I'm trying to have a source of the signal, which I believe I have already, that will give me controllable waveform to the point 11 and a controllable current which I would be able to regulate and eventually may have a control over how much the power is delivered. For this purpose, I have a monster, I have a transformer, I need to somehow set up the current control from the monster or to the transformer, the Glenstra transformer. As far as the voltage, I have no problem with that because I can use any one of generators that I have, probably 10 of them, and I can have a total control over the power. Let me put it this way. If, let's say, I decide to use a generator that has 5 watts of power or 3 watts of power, and I amplified it to 200 volts, and then I would be able to find out how much current I'm getting out of the amplifier. Then by simply adjusting the amplitude of the signal from the generator, I'm playing with the voltage on the output of the amplifier, which then will deliver the signal to the Glenn transformer, and then deliver the signal to point 11. Back to you.
Will Glenn Benz transformer be substituting for the flyback transformer, the thing that's got leads 1, 3, 9, 10, 11. Glenn's transformer is going to substitute for that flyback transformer. Is that true?
Formative.
Sounds like you're getting, since you've now had that in your hands for a day or two, sounds like you're getting pretty close to running that experiment. Is that true?
No, it is not. The reason for that is it was because I was so amazed with the Glenn's transformer, and I put it on the extensive test. I have it right now connected to Advantes R3754B network analyzer at the frequency range from 10 kilohertz to 10 megahertz. What I have it set on the log magnitude and phase, so logarithmic magnitude and the phase. I see the frequency response from the device that's starting from 2.432 megahertz. I have a newly plot characteristic with the phase not jumping over, where the phase starts from 160 degrees and the magnitude being somehow more or less flat up to the point of 8.426 megahertz, where the phase is 35 degrees. So it didn't change from plus to minus. It just changed from 160 degrees to approximately 35 degrees. That's what it shows in dBs. It shows minus 5 dB at 8.426 megahertz. And it shows minus 18.256 dBs at a frequency of 2.5 megahertz. When I was looking at the oscilloscope, I didn't have the same waveform that I was delivering from the generator in shape. It was distorted very much, but what I find out that somewhere from 2 kilohertz up to approximately 60 kilohertz, I'm getting very much precise waveform to the one that I delivered. Now, I was trying to find out a self-resonant frequency of that transformer, and till now, I did not. I didn't have a problem, N2XJN, with flyback transformer. Flyback transformer, I've seen a rapid change of the amplitude from the output. I've seen that I delivered the square wave to the input, and I have had a sinus, beautiful sinus from the output with even amplitude and no ringing on it. As far as this one, I thought that I have the self-resonant frequency of the transformer in about 2.2 megahertz, which I've seen a sine wave, yes, even amplitude, converted from the square wave that I delivered to the primary. But when I went to 1.2 megahertz, I find out that the amplitude was even bigger, but now I still have a reminding of the square wave. Not bad for this transformer. At the same time, when I went to approximately 40 kilohertz, I found out that the amplitude is even bigger. I'm just simply not able to find it. I don't know how to do it. Now, On the diagrams that I have sent you from Glenn's transformer, you have all of the calculations that Glenn made for me. Could you please take a look at those calculations?
When a transformer has a significant amount of distributed capacitance and you sweep it in frequency, one of the definitions, I think, of transformer resonance is where the capacitance and the inductance each create a capacitor reactance and inductive reactance equal to each other, and you and I would call that resonance. Glenn's transformer is quite far spread out. He's wound it in such a way to minimize the amount of stray capacitance of the winding. Therefore, even though it might have a transformer